Oh my, the Lone Ranger. How many of you have actually seen the Lone Ranger? Just out of curiosity. Oh, three more and my wife and I. Great. All right, well, as Paul said, we didn't actually know this wasn't going to be a blockbuster, but it is a fascinating movie, so we're excited that you're here today. My name's Kurt, by the way. Welcome to this holiday weekend at Cross Point. You know, any race weekend in Indianapolis is a holiday weekend in many, many ways, so really excited you've chosen to join us today. And, we are looking at these blockbusters, or at least these films that we thought would be blockbusters, and we're not necessarily endorsing these films. What we're doing, though, is we're finding that there are spiritual themes and threads that run through every movie. Many of the things in our culture actually raise big spiritual questions. And today, as we unpack and look a little bit, we're really using it as a launch pad, the movie The Lone Ranger. This is what we're looking at. We're looking at this idea of, Lone Ranger is deputized. I mean, he's kind of made into a Texas Ranger to go out and do good, to do the right thing and to fight injustices and to fight, corruption in his day. And he finds he's the only one doing this. There's no justice, he says. There's no place that brings justice. So he takes this upon himself to actually begin to instill this in the culture that he lives in his day. Of course, he's got his sidekick Tonto, who joins him in this adventure, and together they go to try to do the right thing. So we're gonna talk about what that looks like today when we find that in the Bible. Before we do that, let's take a moment and pray. God, I'm thankful we can come into a place like this, and I just ask, God, that you would help me to say the things that you want to be said today, because these things line up with what you've said so long ago and in such an accurate way in the Bible. And so, God, I know many of us have different convictions, different ideas about things, but I know you can meet us exactly where we are and take us to an entirely new place, so I pray that happens today. You know, when it comes to doing the right thing, there's a woman who was at the center of a lot of controversy about 10, 12 years ago that really kind of epitomizes for me this idea of somebody who stands up amidst a really, really, really difficult situation and actually does the right thing. This woman was later identified as a Person of the Year by Time Magazine. In fact, there were three women who were the persons of the year that particular year. And her name is Sharon Watkins. You see her here on the right-hand side. She was the CEO of Enron. If you remember the whole Enron fiasco of a little over a decade ago. And she was known as a whistleblower. And all three of these women were whistleblowers in their organizations or their corporate corporations. And they didn't like the term. They actually thought it was a very derogatory term. But what Sharon Watkins did is she actually sent an email to the inbox of CEO Ken Lay and basically said, "Hey, the accounting principles of Enron are not correct. They're not trustworthy. They're not principles of integrity." And people within the Enron organization were unwilling to listen to the truth that she brought, and she was actually made out to be the bad guy for quite some time. And of course, now, years later, we actually see this great integrity that she had as she, kind of spoke truth into that organization and to much of the corruption that was happening, and she's kind of lived her whole life this way is what we find. And so, we're going to talk about a great figure today who lived his life in this way. That great person isn't Sharon Watkins, but it's somebody that Sharon knew a lot about. As a Christ follower, as somebody who's following Jesus, Sharon knew a lot about this guy by the name of Daniel. Maybe you know about Daniel in the lion's den, kind of a popular story from the Bible, even if you're not overly familiar with the Bible. Maybe you've heard the phrase, the writing on the wall. That phrase actually comes from the book of Daniel. These are actually references to this book that was written hundreds and hundreds of years ago. We find it in the New Testament. And it's about this guy named Daniel who basically is a guy of integrity his whole life through. He's going through trying to do the right thing, trying to make the right decision, trying to stand up for people who need to be stood up for, trying to not let the culture shape who he is or what he does or how he follows God. And in many ways, this is similar to what Lone Ranger is doing, fighting for the justice, the injustices, against the injustices of the open range as a deputy ranger. And so we're going to dive into this today. Now, back in the year 600 BC, this is where the Israelites were in bondage to the nation of Babylon. And if you know anything about the Israelites, the Jewish nation known as the Israelites, they do not have a good lineage. I mean, think about this for a moment. It was just like one tragedy after another in terms of their oppression. For many of us, we think about, like the Holocaust, the terrible, tragedy of the Holocaust. That was the latest of a number of tragedies that happened a number of years ago. In a long lineage of just oppressive things that happened to the nation of Israel. And so basically the nation, you know, the Babylonian nation is wanting to take in, you know, they're wanting to identify some 15-year-old boys basically for this young executive training program in the Babylonian nation. And they're trying to build in some diversity into their training program. And one of the reasons they're doing that and they're reaching out to the Israelites is they're basically trying to pull in some of the cultures that they're trying to dominate so they can understand those cultures better. And so they look, you know, they look to form this young executive training program and choose a number of 15-year-old boys. And here's what it says in Daniel chapter 1. It says they're looking for young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. So here we see a number of qualifications they look for. One is only men, meaning this was, you know, understand at this time, men were a dominant figure. It's not that way, obviously, today, but men were, this was not a very sexually sensitive culture, gender-sensitive culture. They were very sexually sensitive, I'm sure. You know, they were not gender-sensitive at that time, and they had to be good-looking men. All right, those were the first two qualifications. And once you passed those two, then you went to the next. You know, they wanted somebody with aptitude, somebody who was quick to understand, well-versed, well-informed, qualified to serve. And in other words, they wanted individuals with a depth to them, with a weightiness to them. And so, you know, this is one of the reasons Daniel is chosen, because Daniel is somebody that has impeccable character. He's somebody from the very beginning, they saw him as somebody who lived a life of integrity. And so as a part of this young executive training program, all these boys were basically going to be indoctrinated into the Babylonian way. And it was kind of one of the ways they scrubbed those kids' national heritage out of them. In fact, one of the ways they did this was they began to get them accustomed to eating the meals of the Babylonian culture. And Daniel has a reaction to this. He has a reaction to the request to eat the meals of the Babylonian culture. In fact, here's what it says in verse 8. It says, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way." Don't understand, it's a 15-year-old boy saying this. Right? To not defile himself actually means to not lose heart, to not lose his integrity. In other words, to not lose his character before God. And just for the sake of being on the same page, let's define integrity for a moment. Integrity, the root word of integrity is actually the word integer. And so if you remember back to math class, an integer is what? A whole number, right? It's not a fraction, it's not a sixth, it's not a half, it's not 11 sixteenths or 15 sixteenths, it's a whole number. And so the idea of integrity based on integer is that there's a wholeness in this person's life. That actually there's a sense that this person is being the same person in whatever environment we find ourselves in. That's what integrity is, being the same. Not a part of myself gets revealed here and a part of myself there. It's being the same person wherever I find myself. And so, listen, it's easy to fall into moralism with this, all right? Moralism is where we just kind of have this idea of having to do everything right. I got to say the right thing, do the right thing for the sake of doing right because I'm trying to be a good person. God's not interested in moralism. What's happening right here with Daniel is actually being the kind of people, the kind of person that God calls us to be a person of wholeness, a life where we're not living fractured sense where I show part of myself here and I'm incongruent here with what I'm doing over here. There's a completeness to him. And so Daniel does something right here that's very critical for us to understand. This is critical to the story right here. He doesn't want to eat the food. And we don't know if it's that he doesn't like the food. We don't know that it's because if he really does feel as we maybe assume that it's in violation to his dietary restrictions or regulations that he's committed to, whatever it might be. He doesn't want to eat the Babylonian food. And so there's a huge thing to understand here. He doesn't wait till this moment to figure this out. All right? He doesn't wait. He's 15. He actually decided before that moment, here's what is right and wrong for me. Now, if you're young, if you're a teenager in the room today, listen, this is huge for me, right? For you right here, right? You need to tune into this right here. You need to take these words, because the younger you are, the more opportunity you have to not have to go back and redo your life, all right? You have a huge opportunity for learning right here. See, Daniel's building his life here. He's decided ahead of time what's right and wrong, which means, you know, if you're dating someone and you're 15 and all of a sudden you find yourself in the back seat of a car with the person you're dating, when the hormones are raging, is not a good time to figure out, you know, what's right and wrong. What are my sexual boundaries? You know, how far am I willing to go? It's not the right time to do that. All right, you need to decide that ahead of time. It means, you know, when you walk in the office tomorrow at 8 o'clock and you have an 8:15 meeting and your boss comes in and hands you a memo that says, "I need you to doctor the numbers a little bit for the 8:15 meeting to make them look better." those 15 minutes are not the time to figure out what are appropriate accounting principles. All right, you need to figure that out ahead of time. If you're in an argument with somebody, not the time to figure out your view on physical violence, all right? You got to figure that out before you get in the argument, because that you see, here's the problem. We get in the heat of battle, and what ends up happening is that we find ourselves, we never settle in our minds what's right and wrong. And we actually defile ourselves in that moment. And we're in the heat of battle, and we lose a piece of ourself. We lose a part of who we are, and we're no longer whole. There's no longer a wholeness. We're fractured. We're a fraction now. And so let's jump forward to the part of the story we understand that we've probably often heard. This is where Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den. And, we have this image in our minds of Daniel, sitting down in the lion's den. If you've seen a flannel graph of this in Sunday school growing up or something, you see Daniel, hovering around the lions, he's hanging out with them. And we picture this young, strapping 16-year-old, right? He came into the program at 15. He's now 16 or 18. No, get this. He's 80 years old. The dude is 80 when he gets thrown into the lion's den. He's 80. All right, realize that he's been around the block from 15 to 80. You know what he's been doing? The same thing every day, trying to do the right thing, make the right decision. From 15 to 80, day after day, he's making these little decisions every day that are building up his character and the weightiness to who he is. But here's what it says about him in Daniel 6. 65 years later from when he entered the program, it says this about him. Now, Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over, get this, the whole, not part, not a fraction, not 3/6, not 5/8, the whole kingdom. So in other words, there's a weightiness to him. There's a wholeness. For 60 years, he's been developing this wholeness. And now King Darius is in charge, and he's going to appoint somebody over the 120 regional leaders. And day after day, Daniel's just been living his life, doing the right thing, and all of the little things every day. And the million-dollar question is, how does he get to this point? He gets to this point because he just follows through every day on what is right. He makes the right decision, the hard decision. Sometimes the hard decision and the right decision are the same. And you know people like this, right? You see people like this in your workplace. You know the person in the boardroom or the meeting room where, they may not be the person with official power, but when they speak, there's a weightiness to what they say because the weight's in their character. Their heart is whole. They're not a different person here than they are over there. And when they speak, everybody's like, oh, man, that settles it. That's exactly the way to see. This is how Daniel is. After decades after that defining moment, decades earlier, 65 years earlier, as a 15-year-old, and saying, I'm not going to eat this food because it violates some things I've chosen about the way I want to live my life. 65 years later, Daniel's still living a truthful, honest life, doing the same thing. The only difference at 80 versus 15 is he's now more seasoned. So, of course, those around him, these other people who are vying for the same position, they're threatened by him. That's what often happens when you have a weightiness to your character. People are threatened by you. And so they see he's got a lot of perks. In fact, he's going to get to lead all these regional leaders. We want that perk. And so you know what they do? They go to the king and they're like, hey, King Darius, we got a great idea. What if you go out and you put an edict into place that says everyone must worship you as king for the next 30 days and no other gods can be worshipped? And Darius is like, great idea. And he's like, done, declared. Nobody worships anything else or anyone else except for me for 30 days. Now, the king did not know that he was actually being set up right here. But see, these other people who were vying for Daniel's position, they were trying to set up the king because they knew that Daniel was a God worshiper. They knew that Daniel was disciplined, that Daniel keeps his heart whole by going directly to God. And so Daniel, he hears this edict, he hears this thing proclaimed that he can't worship any other god but King Darius for the next 30 days. And so what does he do? Look at what he does here in verse 10. It says, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to God, just as he had done before. Then these men went up as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. See, the reason he's never defiled himself to this point is because there's spiritual disciplines that he's built into his life. I mean, you don't have something that helps you get to that point. If you've not built that kind of system into your life, you don't one day just say, you know, today I'm going to start living a life of integrity. It just doesn't happen that way. You actually put systems into place that will help you get to that place of wholeness, to that place of integrity. It's things like saying to your closest friends, I want you to ask me hard questions. I give you permission to ask me hard questions about how I'm living my life. It's things like, you know, reading the Bible and allowing God's truth to reformat your mind, to take it off of what you think and to format it with God's principles. It's things like solitude and prayer. And we're going to be talking about these things 2 weeks from today. We're going to look at the movie Turbo, a great little movie. And we're going to be talking about accelerating your spiritual growth, some of the key disciplines to accelerate our growth. And for Daniel, this is what kept his heart whole. All right, 3 times a day, he's positioning himself in front of a window that faces Jerusalem, and he goes to pray to his God 3 times a day. It's part of his system. And you have to ask yourself, you know, I wonder what Daniel thought when he heard that he wasn't going to be able to do that for the next 30 days. I wonder what he was thinking. I mean, he could have been thinking, man, I'm pretty spiritually grounded. I can probably coast for about 30 days, and I'll be fine. He probably could have, but he didn't do that. You know, he could have thought, I won't go up to my room and pray anymore. I'll actually go outside the city to a quiet place away from everyone and pray there. But he didn't do that either. Why didn't he do that? You know why he didn't do that? Because Daniel would have known. He himself would have known. So you get to a point in your life where you begin to not be as concerned with what other people think about you as you kind of have a real clear picture of what you know about yourself. And you really go to the next place when what you know about yourself is actually informed by what God knows about you. And you begin to make decisions based on what you know God knows about you. So Daniel, he just felt he needed to go through with the spiritual discipline. I mean, this is what got him from 15 to 80 with this life of wholeness, this life of integrity. He says, why would I change this now? This is what took me from here to here. It's a life of discipline. And so, of course, you know, these guys that helped the king put this edict into place, they know this. So they go stand outside his door to his bedroom, and they're listening. And as soon as they hear him open the window and he begins his prayer, they bust in. They're like, aha, look, we knew it. Look at what he's doing. He's praying. Darius, look at what has happened. King, he's violating your edict. And Darius, man, he's incredibly bummed out. All right, I mean, his advisor, his right-hand guy, and he understood, the king knew that once an edict is proclaimed, as it was in all cultures at that point, it couldn't be reversed. So, I mean, you know, the king's in like between a rock and a hard place. So let's pause the story for a moment. How does Daniel know? I mean, how do we get to that place of knowing what is right? How do we, in the midst of difficult circumstances? So I want to give us three ways that we kind of know how to do the right thing in difficult times. The first is what's called the conscience. Now, the conscience is interesting. You're never going to be able to empirically test the conscience, all right? It's not like we can take a cadaver, you know, somebody's died, and like put them on a table and slice them all up and try to find the conscience there. You can't like lay it on the table and say, there it is, here it is. We can test this thing now. But yet... we know the conscience exists. How do we know it exists? Because across all time periods, across all cultures, there's kind of a stamped in sense of what's right and what's wrong that we just kind of innately know. I mean, across time periods, across cultures, it's just known that it's wrong if you're on the field of battle with your other warriors and you, in the heat of battle, turn around and run. Everybody's just like, that's wrong. We know it's empirically wrong if, you know, for a CEO to lead his business to a terrible place and then bail and go to a better position. I see it in churches. I see pastors who lead their churches to terrible places and bail, and I sit back and I'm like, that's wrong. There's a lack of character right there. See, this is actually a great indication that there actually is a designer. There's some kind of, you know, greater being that actually designs us and creates us and wires us and kind of stamp certain things, hardwire certain things like right and wrong into our being. Martin Luther King, he said something really fascinating. He said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter the most. You know what's interesting about the Enron deal? All of their internal stationery had that quote printed on it right there. So get this. The executives at Enron, they're taking notes in meetings. They're sending memos to one another. And they're literally writing their memos over this phrase that says, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about the things that matter the most. And what's interesting about that is I think that's what happens when we lose our conscience. I think we have certain things we know are right and wrong, and we just begin to write over the top of them and say, you know what, I'm going to begin to do it this way. And we lose our conscience. We lose it. We ignore it. I mean, everybody ignored it at Enron except Sharon Watkins. She was the only one that said, hey, this isn't right. Something about this isn't right. Now, there's actually three consciences that are actually revealed within the Bible. I mean, this I didn't say, here's conscience one, here's conscience two, but we see these throughout the scriptures. The first one, this is interesting because all of us are in one of these. You might kind of sit there and try to figure out, okay, where am I at? Which category do I fall in? The first one is the strong conscience, and that's where we accurately can sense what's right and wrong. All right, that's when something happens and you're like, oh, I know exactly what needs to be done right here, because you're very clearly able to say, okay, this is wrong and this is the right decision. You know, a couple months ago, I was in a board meeting, and one of our board members was talking about something really great that happened here at Cross Point when they were here, and they're kind of giving me the credit for it, and I'm just sitting there, you know, and my conscience is saying, Kurt, you know you're not responsible for this. Now, I know, I mean, as a leader, I ultimately am. I'm ultimately the stopgap for everything, but you know, my conscience said, you need to speak up and give credit where it's due. And so I did. I said, you know, man, it's awesome. I'm glad that happens. Obviously, we're creating great culture, but this person is the reason that you experience what you experience right there. See, there's just a right and wrongness with the conscience that comes to us. It's like, you know, we know it's not good to drink too much. It's good to not cheat on your taxes. There's just certain things. The strong conscience says, you know, you're going to accurately know what's right and wrong. The second conscience is the weak conscience. And you would logically assume the weak conscience has to do with not following the rules, but it's actually different. The weak conscience in the Bible is somebody who is all about the rules, right? They have to legalize and mandate and define everything, every jot and tittle. They got to just like get every little detail, you know, so there's no stepping out of, you know, any parameters. In fact, a few years ago, I was on a symposium panel of some kind, and I remember being on this panel, and the question, kind of a controversial question apparently, was posed. I didn't realize it was controversial. The question was, you know, do you believe in interracial marriages? And I was kind of stunned by it, to be completely honest. And normally I have a really good answer. Normally I'm like quick on the draw, and I can just, you know, immediately, you know, say something. And I just had one of those like slurpy brain freeze moments where you're like, you know, my brain locked down. And I was bothered that I didn't have a response, and I realized one of the reasons was because I'd never thought through that question before. Nobody had ever posed that question to me before, you know. And I was just stunned by that. And apparently, this person came from some heritage that I'm familiar with, that kind of felt like you had to, you know, mandate everything, and people can and can't do this and that. And I was just stunned because in all the Bible reading I've done, and all the study I've done, all the education I've had, it's never even dawned on me that interracial marriage is a bad thing. I mean, never. I mean, you know, somebody will say, well, but doesn't it say you shouldn't be unequally yoked? You know what that's referring to? That's referring to the spiritual family that you're marrying. That's like Jews should marry Jews. If you're a Christ follower, you should marry a Christ follower. If you're a non-believer, marry somebody who's not a believer. You shouldn't, you know, mix spiritual families. It has nothing to do with ethnicities. I think multiracial marriage is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. I have a lot of friends. Beautiful. And yeah, I just realized this person that asked the question came from a heritage that had to mandate and legalize and, you know, have an opinion and define every little thing. No playing cards, no smoking, no drinking, no, you know, just on and on and on and on. Because that's what a weak conscience does. We have to over-mandate everything. Third conscience is called the seared conscience. And this is the inability to sense between right and wrong. In fact, this is interesting. Timothy, in Timothy's first letter, he actually talks about this. Here's what he says. He says, such teachings come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. A few years ago, I learned a lot about Burns. Our now six-year-old Maggie was one at the time, and we were at some friend's house, and they had a fire in their fireplace blazing. I mean, it was blazing hot, and, you know, they had those glass doors on the front of it, and Maggie's just kind of toddling around, you know, and she saw fire, and she just went to it. We're bad parents, I know. You're going to think that then. You know, she just, like, went right to it, and she got up to it and did this number on the glass. And immediately, I mean, she's, you know, just hysterically crying and inconsolable. We couldn't console her. I mean, blisters, we're putting, you know, wet paper towels and water and all kinds of things. Unconsolable. 30 minutes later, still unconsolable. So Julie's like, you know, we got to either take her to the emergency room or call our doctor. We're friends with our doctor. We called him right away. And he said something really interesting to Julie. I never knew this. Learned something. He said, the first words he said to her, he said, Julie, I can hear her screaming in the background. The fact that she's screaming is a good thing. He He said, you know, it means it's a first or second degree burn, because by the time you get to a third degree burn, it actually sears the nerves and you don't actually feel the burn. This is what happens with our consciences. We actually sear the nerves. And we don't even have the ability to discern between right and wrong. And so we lose the ability. So where are you? You have to say, where am I? Do I have a strong conscience, a weak conscience? Do I have to over-mandate everything? Do I have a seared conscience? Do I have an inability to discern right and wrong? Second way we can know out of the life of Daniel, we can say, okay, here's how to make the right thing in its difficult circumstances. The second way we get that is convictions from God. Now, this is not conscience, all right? Conscience is that innate wiring that says, you know, certain things are right, certain things are wrong. These are kind of those little inner leadings, those promptings. All right, this is where, you know, we get those little moments where God speaks to us and we maybe get nudged. And, you know, like I was, you know, overheard something the other day and I wasn't a part of a conversation with my in-laws, and they're talking church stuff, and I immediately jumped in and started giving my opinion. And as soon as I did, I thought, Kurt, you idiot, you should have kept your mouth shut. I mean, you did not need to insert yourself. The conscience, you know, the convictions of those moments that say, just be quiet, and I override them at times. You know, those are convictions. When I first became began a relationship with Jesus, all right, I'd grown up with religion. All right, I grew up with my dad as a pastor. My mom played the organ. I had religion. I was Captain Religion. All right, I could have had a T-shirt, Captain Religion. You know, but when I moved from doing the religion thing to actually understand that Jesus wants a relationship, and I began to do the relationship thing, everything changed. And I had somebody who came alongside me and kind of explained it to me, and they said, you know, Kurt, having a relationship with God is kind of like you're driving down the journey of life, and because God wants a relationship with you, he's going to talk to you along the way. You're gonna get nudgings. You're gonna hear a voice, may not be audibly. There's gonna be things you're gonna feel like, okay, I need to do this. God's gonna say things like, you're gonna be going down the road, and he's gonna pop flags up and be like, danger, 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 stay away, and you're gonna know what it is. All right, and here's the thing. In those moments, here's the million-dollar moment, you're going to have the decision of whether you're going to actually honor the flags and kind of go around them, or if you're going to bull right through them. And they're very bright, by the way. They're very bright. I mean, they're very noticeable. I mean, because God wants a relationship. He's going to speak and point things out. But because we're on the road and we want to go someplace and we have a lot of passion and we want to do things our way, you know, it's going to be easy at times to see those flags pop up, danger, danger, danger. And you know what we do? We just are like, we just go right over them. That's a pretty good sound, wasn't it? My son used to do that. You know, we just like bull right over the flags. And then again, we go a little further down the road, and all of a sudden the flags pop up because God wants a relationship. He's like, hey, danger. And again, we're just kind of like, we just go right over the flags. And before long, you know, the flags get a little darker because we've been run over so many times. They're not as noticeable. And eventually, after you've, you know, bowled them over a handful of times, you break the sticks off, and they don't even pop up anymore. And that's kind of like, it's kind of like God saying, you know, I thought you wanted a relationship. But apparently you don't want a relationship. Me, I keep nudging, I keep talking to you, but you're not listening. And so I just won't talk anymore. And we find ourselves in a very distant, distant place from God. See, those convictions come. We have to honor the flags. It's a very, very unique thing that God does for those he has a relationship with. And what do you do when you get to the place where your flags are broke and you've kind of run over those flags so many times? Conscience is seared. You have to rebuild it. And the way that you rebuild it is actually going the other way, and that's receiving truth. You actually receive commands from God. And this is where the Bible just gives us basic, basic commands. I mean, basic, basic truths. And if you've never kind of dove into the Bible to allow it to begin to reformat, you know, your sense of reality, then just open a Bible up to the very middle, Proverbs. Put your thumbs in the middle and just open it. You'll go right to the book of Proverbs. Great place to start. All kinds of little nuggets of wisdom and life experience and how to make good decisions and how to grow. And if you don't have a Bible, stop by Connection Point. We have tons of them. We love to give Bibles away. They're free. You can just take one with you. And this is critical. I mean, having, you know, daily reformatting our minds. Again, we're going to talk about this a little more in 2 weeks, some of these spiritual growth accelerators. But if you're here today and you don't have a daily way that you receive truth, here's a way to do it. You can go to BibleGateway.com/newsletters, and you can actually receive a daily emailed scripture verse to you or devotional thought. There's all kinds of options. You can, and this is a next step today, too, on your connection card. if you want to receive something every day that gives you something a little to read on the way to work, or once you get to the office, or as soon as you get up, you know, there's things for men, for women, for business people, for moms, I mean, all kinds of categories that kind of will bring things into your life that connect with where you are. Just mark that on your card, and I'll send you a link this week on how to sign up for that. See, the key right here, the key is every day I have to figure out what's right and wrong. I need to make decisions based on, and sometimes I don't know, so I need something speaking into my life. Let me give you one of my more recent examples. We were heading out of town a couple weeks ago, and I went to the bank machine late at night, and I was sitting behind somebody at the bank machine, and as soon as they were done, they kind of sped off, and I pulled up to put my card in, and I noticed the screen on the bank machine said, "Do you want another transaction?" Absolutely, if it's their money. I mean, wow. It's like, I'm thinking this is like a pay it forward moment, right? Like, you know, paying for the person behind you's drink at Starbucks. They just left their bank account for me to like get a blessing, right? I mean, doesn't the Bible say finders, keepers, losers, weepers or something like that? I mean, I think it does. That's not the right time to determine your view on stealing, all right? I'd already resolved that for myself, all right? And so in that moment, I knew exactly what to do. No, I don't want to. Actually, I do want a transaction, but I'm going to use my account. So I hit no. You went through the whole thing of putting my stuff in there. See, the moment that happened, the flags are maintained. The flags are honored. The heart is maintained and kept whole. See, this is what Daniel went through. This is how Daniel walked it out. And so we find Daniel 65 years later, he's maintained his integrity. He's maintained his conscience. And now King Darius is in this sticky, sticky situation where he's got to get rid of his right-hand guy. He's got to get rid of him. And so you know what he does? He throws him, as is normal in that time, into this big hole in the ground, this den of lions. He throws him in. He puts a rock over the top of it, and he seals it with wax and puts his signet ring. He actually embeds his signet ring into it to put a seal around it, because if anybody messed with that wax seal, they would actually be put to death as well. And for 24 hours, Daniel was in that den of lions. And listen, Darius is like, King Darius, he's on the edge of his seat. I mean, he can't wait, and he's hoping, he's praying. He's like, I hope the power of Daniel's life comes through for him again. Because you see, he knew Daniel. He knew that there were miraculous things that happened in Daniel's life, because Daniel honored God at every single turn. And in exchange, God would honor Daniel in the same way. So 24 hours later, to the moment, you know, on the money, Daniel goes down, or King Darius goes down and removes the rock. He's like, Daniel, did God come through for you? Did the God come through again? And look at what it says. Here's exactly what it says. Daniel says, "My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." And he's like, King, I'm good. Darius, God did this incredible thing. He came through and he actually protected me for the last 24 hours. And King, you just need to know, I would never do anything to dishonor you. I would never do anything to not bring honor to you. There's nothing I would do to wrong you. And listen, Darius is like fired up, right? So he takes those other two dudes that got him to actually make that edict, and he takes them and throws them into the den. The moment they hit the ground, their bones are broke and they're devoured by the lions. It's like nice, wrapped up, great little story, right? At least depending on the perspective you look at it from. So here's the thing. You know, maybe you're a cynic sitting here today, which by the way, I like you if you are, because I'm kind of that way. I'm a cynic at heart. And you're just thinking, man, there you go. There's a nice little Christian way to do it. Everything resolves great. Everybody has a happy ending, because I've never seen it that way in my life. Well, let me tell you why. You know, my life doesn't always work that way either. I can tell you that I try to do the right thing, and it doesn't always go the way that I thought it should have gone. But I also can tell you that God never leaves me right there. And for whatever reason, the story of Daniel, this is the way it ends. It did go this way in this case. And there's a lesson here for all of us. I mean, if you're a person of integrity doing the right thing only so that you can get to something else, then there's actually something missing in your life. I mean, if you're doing the right thing just long enough to get to the right thing, you're like dating the person you're dating and trying to do the right thing just so you can marry them, or you're, you know, marrying somebody just so you can get to having kids, or you're, you know, saying, hey, I'm taking this car right now just so I can, I'm just enduring with this just so I can get to the car I really want, or I'm living in this house just until I can get enough to get this house, or, you know, I'm in this position just long enough, I'm trying to do the right thing here just so I can get to the next thing. Listen, I think God may want to say to you, listen, I want to do something unique in your life right now. I actually want to grow your heart in the situation you're in right now. There's something unique that I can do only in the place you're in right now. I mean, for Daniel, this is how it worked for him. 15 to 20 to 60 to 75 to 80 for 65 years, he just did the right thing wherever he was at. And God continued to do something unique in his life right there. And if we're always thinking, man, I'm doing the right thing, and I'm going for this, and you know what you're doing? You're actually plowing probably through the flags. There's actually a lot of things God may be wanting to teach you along the way. But you're violating your conscience. You're actually violating your heart. You're compromising your integrity. And we actually just get further and further away from God in that moment. Let's pray. God, I want to thank you for this story. I want to thank you for the heroes that we can learn from, for heroes like Sharon Watkins, for heroes like Daniel. And my prayer today, God, is that we can be a hero like that for other people that will eventually look to us. And the way that will happen is by us being the kind of people today that do the right thing. That even amidst the difficult circumstances we may be in right now, we're going to find out what is the right thing right here, and then we go do it. And God, every single one of us can become a model like this. And I pray that happens for us this morning. As we pray, God, I realize it's probably something that came to every single one of our minds this morning. You know, whether it came through your conscience or maybe a conviction from God, you know, something that, at least I hope there is, I hope there's something that came to our mind as we process this story today. And as you look at that thing, I just want to ask you to resolve in your heart right now what you're going to do as you get up out of this room and go and get after that thing. I mean, resolve it right now. That thing may be the key to restoring your heart. That thing may be the key to restoring your wholeness. God, just help us to do that today. Amen. Well, as we get ready to sing here in a moment, I want to ask you to take out your connection cards that Paul referred to earlier. And on the back of these are some next steps. As he said, you know, we're really big. We don't want you to just come into this place, but we care about your growth, and we want to send you out with us saying, you know, here's my next step based on what I experienced here today. And I'm not going to walk through these, but there's a number of steps that really connect with some of the things we talked about. Take a moment and just resolve. I mean, just resolve right here before you go on with the rest of your day. Here's what I need to do. And resolve that and invite God into that situation and see where he takes you. And we'll see.